Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, the importance of knowing how to do cardiopulmonary resuscitation and having someone who knows CPR near to you when you have a cardiac arrest in the street. We'll get our teeth into misleading dental data in Australian children and saving bloods and saving lives and money at the same time. What could be more symbolic of modern medicine than the blood transfusion? We're exhorted to donate blood to save lives. Yet internationally, blood is one of the most wasted products in healthcare. In fact, its use is associated with risk and poor outcomes. A radical program called Patient Blood Management, pioneered and researched in Western Australia, has shown spectacular results and is now being adopted internationally. Using less blood has resulted in fewer deaths and significant financial savings. In our Perth studio is Gary Gilhode, Chief Medical Officer of Western Australia, and on the line, Simon Tyler, a former Chief Medical Officer of WA, who's involved with blood management reform at a national level in Australia. Welcome to you both to the Health Report.
Hi, Norman.
Good evening, Norman.
Simon, you were here from kind of the beginning. We'll get to Gary in a moment. How did WA get to be the international leader in blood management?
Look, Norman, there's been programs in Western Australia dating back for a long time. In fact, some of the early programs started in small hospitals, particularly focusing on providing the opportunity for blood-free surgery for Jehovah's Witnesses. But what became clear was that patients managed through those programs were doing well. And in fact, internationally, it became increasingly clear that the evidence suggesting there was, shall we say, the possibility of harm with transfused blood products was growing substantially.
So what sort of harm? Look,
the things that we know are almost certain is that as you increase the amount of transfused product administered, the risk of infection increases in most clinical settings. There's quite a lot of evidence now accumulated suggesting that transfusion alters the immune system and can change outcomes, such that there's certainly suggestive evidence that transfusion at the time of surgery for cancer may be associated with higher rates of recurrence. And so this evidence has been growing over time, balanced by a lack of real evidence of quality benefit from getting transfused, and certainly when you transfuse above what are recommended levels. So those things taken together suggested that quality practice in transfusion in the care of patients was something that was well worth focusing on. When I became the Chief Medical Officer in Western Australia, we thought this was a good place to start. And worldwide, this has now been strongly taken up.
And we'll come back to that later. And just before I get to Gary Gilhode, Simon, I mean, when you started this study, I think 2008, I mean, Western Australia was already a low user of blood. I mean, there's important context when you hear the spectacular results, as we will from Gary in a moment. You were already internationally a low user of blood products.
Yes, we were, but I think because there'd been programs in Western Australia and we'd been looking at what was possible, and also we'd been looking at what was going on in individual hospitals across the world, we recognised that we could improve further, and I'm sure Gary will outline what's been achieved. But the focus is very much on the patient, not just on the transfusion. We believe that patient blood management is a descriptor of quality clinical care, not a particular focus on transfusion practice itself.
So Gary Gilhode, tell us about there's three pillars of this. It's not simply teaching surgeons to do better surgery or do more blood-free surgery. You call it three pillars of the blood management system in WA. Just briefly describe them.
Yeah, thanks, Norman. Look, essentially, a simple way to think about this, because most blood products are actually given for, you know, electively, that is for elective surgery rather than, you know, in emergency situations. So you do have a chance to change these things. And so the simplest way to think about it is, first of all, optimizing red cell mass. Second pillar is minimizing blood loss. And third one, harness and optimize physiological reserve. Now, the easiest way to think about that is preoperatively. When patients came in the past, perhaps we didn't take quite so much care if they were found to be anemic, or we might just transfuse them then and then take them to theatre. During theatre, again, people would maybe not take as much care about blood loss, et cetera, as that maybe they had, and also after. So you put those things together, both preoperatively, now patients, you would try and make sure they were much more fitter, they had a higher hemoglobin or iron, you know, red blood cell mass in their bodies before they went to theatre, so much less likely to need to be transfused. If during theatre you actually use techniques so you minimise blood loss, and in some cases where it's appropriate, actually recycled, you know, blood that you're using during the surgery, and using appropriate anticoagulants and so on, or at least, sorry, the opposite of that, then, and also postoperatively taking all care, what you find is your need to actually give blood, for the reason Simon said, you know, it can be life-saving, but in most cases you should try and avoid blood products as much as you can, that leads to better outcomes.
And you weren't so religious about saying that a certain level of hemoglobin, you need to have a transfusion. It depends on the person's physical state as to whether they need it.
Very much so. You know, it was all about horses for courses, and so we weren't too prescriptive there, because as you can imagine, people's pre-existing conditions or the reasons why they were getting or might need a blood transfusion would vary greatly. So it, to some extent, it was sort of really raising people's awareness to say, look, think of it in every case. Do you need to definitely transfuse this person? And if so, do they need more than one unit of blood? So, for instance, it used to be that only about a third of cases got only one unit of blood. And with our program, that sort of virtually doubled, so that two-thirds would only get one unit of blood, because the negative things that Simon was talking about, a lot of it is sort of dose-related.
And you taught surgeons, well, surgeons taught other surgeons blood-free techniques.
Well, that's right, and so was
or low blood loss techniques.
Yeah, look, there was a whole suite of things that were introduced. So this was people seeing the patients before theatre, the people who dealt with the patients during theatre and after theatre. A lot of it was actually, in this modern day and age, actually getting the data and feeding that back to the surgeon, showing them what their blood usage was compared to their peers and other departments and other hospitals. So that's a very, you know, sort of a positive way of getting people to change their, you know, their behaviour.
So you've just published your findings. You and Simon are on the paper. What were the headline findings from a six-year study of this program?
Well, in some ways, the point about this was taking the evidence that was available and then applying it sort of system-wide across Western Australia, because many people will be appalled to find that many times with, you know, research findings, it takes anywhere between 5 to 12 or more years to get into practice. This was an attempt to system-wide change things, because we had the evidence to show that a lot of this time the blood wasn't needed and, in fact, it was bad for patients. So, first of all, it was just looking at the units of, you know, blood or blood products that were being used per admission. And that dropped 41% during the 5-6 years that the study was on.
And then this enormous saving of money, between $80 and $100 million, not just in blood products, but in the consequences of all the savings. You've got lower death rates, lower numbers of heart attacks,
exactly,
and strokes.
It was a win-win situation where you're getting better health outcomes and you're saving money. And as you say, many of those things where, as Simon said, the evidence was emerging that perhaps, you know, giving blood unnecessarily were causing these things. So as you say, the things that dropped, hospital mortality dropped actually, length of stay in hospital, hospital-acquired infections dropped, associated heart attacks and stroke for patients who've, you know, had the blood products and had the surgery. All these things moved in a very positive direction, and you can see obviously how you're going to save a lot of money too once those things start coming down.
So Simon Towler, just briefly, I take it this has been taken up with alacrity, not in Australia. I mean, it's been taken up internationally. I think the European community has now adopted the WA system. Has the rest of Australia? You sit on the National Committee.
So the uptake has been variable. There's now a collaborative that's been formed with the Australian Commission for Safety and Quality in Healthcare, taking a group of leading hospitals and looking at what works within the institutions. But I go back to one of the key recommendations that came out of patient blood management was that health services establish a multidisciplinary, multimodal perioperative blood management program. In other words, a team of people with expertise in the different elements of care, working on and putting in place reliable programs in the hospital to ensure these things are actually implemented. And I think the disappointing thing is that despite this being a central recommendation and there being significant changes in clinical practice at the individual level for the very reasons that Gary has talked about, the widespread application of a program approach, in my view, has still not progressed as much as would be best and would lead to the best possible outcomes. And I think the recent paper confirming that reduced complications and reduced health costs should give greater import to those people in decision-making positions to adopt a PBM approach on a systematic basis.
Thank you very much to you both. That was Simon Towler, former CMO of Western Australia, Chief Medical Officer. He's gone back to his work as an intensive care specialist, amongst other things, and Gary Gilhood, who's the current Chief Medical Officer of Western Australia. Congratulations and thanks for you both. You're listening to The Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. A Danish study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine reinforces the recommendation that all of us should know basic cardiopulmonary resuscitation for that moment when someone has a cardiac arrest in front of us. A one-year follow-up of the outcomes of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and whether there was a bystander who performed CPR or grabbed a public defibrillator has shown significant benefits. The lead author is Christian Krakholm, who's at Aalborg University Hospital in Denmark. Thanks for sparing Australia your time, Dr. Krakholm.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
So briefly, the study, what did you do?
So briefly, what we did was we used data from the Danish Cardiac Arrest Registry, which is a nationwide registry containing information on all cardiac arrests in Denmark that occurred since June 2001. And what we did was we linked this information, this cardiac arrest information, including information on whether laypersons or EMS personnel witnessed the arrest, whether it was unwitnessed, whether bystanders stepped in and started CPR, and also whether bystander used an AED defibrillator for patients. So we took this information and we linked it to other nationwide registries in Denmark. We have a unique social security number that we use in all healthcare and social contexts. And so we use this unique social identifier to link to other nationwide registries, other hospital record registries, and also registries on nursing home admission and other social care needs.
And I'll just say in passing, Christian, before we go on, that this linkage of registers and availability of registers can only be dreamed about in Australia with our anxiety about privacy, which would not allow this kind of data analysis that you've been able to do. So what did you find in relation to bystander CPR?
So what we found was that in addition to increasing patient survival and lowering mortality, we also found a significantly lower risk of nursing home admission and brain damage following out of hospital cardiac arrest. So not only can bystanders increase a person's chance of survival if they start CPR and or if they use a public AED, they can also significantly lower that person's risk of surviving with disabilities.
And have you got particularly high rates of bystander CPR in Denmark compared to other countries? I mean, I noticed that it went up during this period of the study from, 60-odd% to 80%. In other words, there was a lot of bystander CPR going on in Denmark, clearly.
Yes. So what we found during the course of our Danish cardiac arrest registry time was really remarkably. We found that in the beginning, in 2001, we only around 20% of all Danes started CPR when there was a cardiac arrest. And now we have rates up to 65. And in this study, where we study 30-day survivors, obviously the CPR rates are higher because CPR is associated with higher chances of survival. But still, among survivors, we saw a significant increase from around 60-65% to more than 80% during the time or the study period we had.
What proportion of people were actually using the publicly available defibrillators, which are still not that common in Australia, versus jumping on the chest and doing the high rates of chest compression?
Yeah, and that's also another significant market story of our manuscript here, because what we saw was that in the beginning, hardly anyone used a public defibrillator, simply because they weren't available, they weren't accessible. But during the course of our study, we also saw a significant increase in public defibrillation from around 1-2% to up to 15% among survivors, and it increased among all cardiac arrest patients from around or less than 1% to up around 4%.
So your message is learn CPR.
Yes, so the message is learn CPR, but also use a public AED if accessible, if available. And the message is not only to the public, but it's also to policymakers to find ways how to make a defibrillator accessible to the public.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Christian Krekholm is in the Department of Anesthesia and Intensive Care at Aalborg University Hospital in Denmark. And if you're wondering what the current thing on CPR is, it's 120 firm compressions in the centre of the chest a minute. You don't necessarily have to do mouth to mouth anymore, but if you were, you do 30 fast compressions to two, but make sure somebody's calling for an ambulance at the same time. Thanks for that, and in an important story. Now, we typically think about diseases in isolation as distinct entities, but a new model of health wants us to consider the interaction of different diseases along with environmental and social factors. This is the syndemics model of health. Meryl Singer is a medical anthropologist and professor of anthropology at the University of Connecticut, who recently wrote about syndemics for The Lancet. Welcome to the Health Report, Professor Singer.
Thank you.
So, syndemic, what is a syndemic? You just better take us back to, you know, syndemics 101. What are they?
A syndemic, the term refers to a situation where someone, especially at the population level, where there are multiple diseases in a population, and within individuals, those diseases interact with each other in adverse ways. In other words, one disease causes another to either spread more quickly or to cause more damage, or they both impact each other. And usually this occurs under social conditions of poverty or other marginal conditions that make people vulnerable or cause diseases to be concentrated in a particularly at-risk population. So it's really what we refer to as a biosocial situation, because there is interaction at the biological level between diseases and interaction between disease and social conditions.
So what you're trying to do is force a way of thinking which takes all factors into account, not just the disease itself as a single entity.
Well, we're trying to call attention to the fact that diseases often do not occur in isolation, that people who suffer from one condition, that condition may be interacting with other diseases, and that's what often makes things worse. And there are many examples of this.
So why don't you give us an example which you think typifies a syndemic?
A good contemporary example is the interaction between HIV and tuberculosis. When those two infectious diseases are present in the body, both those conditions are made worse by the presence of the other. So people deteriorate more quickly if both diseases are present. There are pathways of interaction within the body, and that interaction does indeed tend to be most frequent in marginalized or oppressed populations, the poor, etc. And it's one of the contemporary syndemics that, you know, has raged in recent times.
And what about obesity?
But we could go back. Obesity is a factor in a number of different syndemics. One of them recently was described in a study in Puerto Rico by a professor, Cher Lerman, who looked at obesity, diabetes, and depression as interacting conditions that tend to make each other worse.
And moving to the developed world, to countries like United States and Australia, what would you say in the United States context, I don't expect you to know about Australia, would be the most significant syndemic in the United States at the moment?
At the moment, and it's a somewhat unusual syndemic from the way I just described it, is the interaction among tick-borne diseases like Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. Right now, tick-borne diseases are the most significant vector-borne disease in the United States. There's multiple different diseases that are spreading to new areas, probably impacted by climate change that's making new habitats more available to vectors like ticks. And so we see people coming down not with one tick-borne infection, but with multiple infections. And in some cases, they get sicker faster because of the interaction among those.
So I suppose I'm kind of surprised at you saying this, because I understand the concept here holistically, but I would have thought that heart disease, which kills more Americans than almost anything else, kills more Australians, would be the one that you would choose. I mean, isn't heart disease the classic syndemic? Or have I missed the point here?
Well, obviously, heart disease is in itself is the most significant individual cause of death, but it isn't always because of syndemic interaction. In and of itself, heart disease is quite capable of killing people, but certainly it does interact with other diseases. It hasn't been well studied as a syndemic, but it's an area, like many syndemics, that have not been examined closely in terms of how actual conditions are interacting. Some of the diseases that heart disease interact with are really not independent of heart disease. They're part of the same set of conditions. So when we talk about syndemics, we're talking about conditions that exist on their own, and in some individuals are co-present and interactive.
So let's go to HIV and tuberculosis, which is an enormous problem, particularly in South Africa, but in other places as well. How does redefining that complex of problems help deal with it?
Well, I think in that case, that redefinition has occurred. That is, that people now fully recognize how damaging that interaction is and have made that the focus of intervention, which is that you can't just treat one or the other. You can't define one as the dominant disease, which is typically how things occurred in the past. It's, you might recognize that there were multiple diseases present, but define one as the important one to address. With HIV and TB, people know that you have to address both of those conditions because they both individually are quite capable of being lethal. So that approach is already fully in place, and it's from that example that we need to learn that you need to think about not just how you treat two diseases, but do the two treatments negatively interact with each other, which happens sometimes when you give people multiple medicines, and you need to think about the social conditions that promote the concentration of those conditions in particular populations.
Now, one of your colleagues at the University of Connecticut has written about the refugee crisis, in, particularly in Europe, and human rights and how that comes together in a syndemic. Could you just talk a little bit about where human rights fits into this complex of disease on social conditions, economics, education, and so on, and indeed human rights?
Well, it has to do with the social conditions that promote disease concentrations. When populations are denied the right to health care, the right to clean water, the right to reliable access to food, they're going to suffer from health consequences. And it's those conditions that promote the occurrence of syndemics. So a rights framework at least provides a legal way to talk about one of the ways to address the upstream causes of syndemics.
Dr. Singer, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Professor Merrill Singer is a professor of anthropology at the University of Connecticut. Now, from time to time, we at the Health Report wake up to the fact that the mouth is part of the body, not to mention the teeth. The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has recently released data on the oral health of Australian children, which both the report and a researcher in the field reckons contradicts previous surveys. Professor Mark Tennant is the director and founder of the International Research Collaborative on Oral Health and Equity at the University of Western Australia. Welcome to the Health Report, Mark.
G'day, Norman. Nice to hear from you.
So what's the problem?
Well, Norman, it's interesting. If we go back in time, dental decay in children was a condition that every kid, you and I of our generation as kids, every kid had some sort of decay problem. And over the last 30 years, through all sorts of mechanisms, that's diminished. And what's happened is around the year 2000, all this time we have had annual or nearly annual reports on the dental health of children. And around the year 2000, as the effects of fluoride and toothpaste and general hygiene really reduced decay rates, we saw that the data started to become more irregular in the reporting. And in fact, there was hints of a trend upward, which was discussed for a long while.
Things were getting worse, according to the data.
Yes, getting worse. More decay in children since the year 2000. There was all sorts of discussions as to the reasons why and things. And just last year, just before Christmas, The group who has been collecting this data for the AIHW over the last 25 years or so, they released a book. And towards the back of the book, it seems that they have pointed out that this new data that they have collected on a very much more stable sort of scientific sampling basis has found that decay rates are actually much lower than the previous reports were starting to raise. In fact, half for 12-year-olds, which is the usual age we measure decay in.
So there's a difference of 50%. So in other words, they're 50% lower than you would have otherwise thought.
Yes.
So which is accurate, the new one or the old one?
Well, I think it's interesting you ask that. I think the new one is done on a much more structured sampling basis.
So it's good news. Australian children have better dental health than we previously thought. Is it good by international? So let's assume that that's the standard. We get into an endless statistical argument here.
Yeah.
So that assumes that, I mean, some people are saying, well, fluoride doesn't work, but this assumes that fluoride does work, helps that argument.
Look, I think this does show we have really good oral health in this country for children. In fact, somewhere close to between 60 and 70% of children are not affected by decay at all up to the age of 12. The issue now is that decay is clustered in small groups of the population. And we are talking the groups of marginalised people in poverty, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. In fact, this report shows something in the range of four times the rates of decay of the rest of the population are in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. So what this new data shows us is instead of having universal services, we should be highly targeted to particular risk groups now.
So if you're planning, there's very scarce resources going into dental health for children, what you're saying is here, focus on where the problem really is.
Yes, you know, there's been discussion about proportionate universalism, which, you know, for your listeners, that sort of means have universal coverage, but, you know, do a little bit of focus on those more at risk.
So are, are Aboriginal children living in unfluoridated areas? I mean,
Yes, interesting question. No, and it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's actually not about purely the fluoride in water. We are talking, if you look across the world, the effects in reduction of decay in children is not always tied to water fluoridation. It's probably related to all sorts of things, including toothpaste and brushing. So there is a lot more to the story than just water.
And the solution, if you intervened and you had, we haven't got much time left, but you've got money to intervene, what would you do with disadvantaged groups who are disproportionately affected by dental decay?
Oh, I would be getting, you know, highly targeted preventive services out there, brushing programs in schools. They've been shown across the world to be effective. I'd be moving to having services near those people in need instead of having
services.
So this
services, is like fissure sealing and application of fluoride, you know, in remote dental chairs, things like that.
Yes, and actually removing dental decay, you know, some fillings and things as well. Let's clean up decay. Just to give you an idea, about the poorest 20% of our population has, you know, somewhere, you know, like 30 times the rates of facial cellulitis from dental disease. You know, this is a disease that's now focused its issues and problem in the poor and marginalised of our society.
Mark Tennant, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Professor Mark Tennant is the Director and Founder of the International Research Collaborative on Oral Health and Equity at the University of Western Australia. I'm Norman Swan. This has been the Health Report. See you next week.